it's tuned to Yesterday, delivering programs from radio's yesteryear. I'm your host, Mark Levonier, for an hour of mystery. Later on, the new adventures of Michael Shane from In and About 1948. But first, the adventures of Sam Spade with the Vafio Murder Cup Caper. The CBS broadcast first heard on August 22nd, 1948.
The Adventures of Sam Spade, Detective. Brought to you by Wild Root Cream Oil Hair Tonic. The non-alcoholic hair tonic that contains lanolin. Wild Root Cream Oil. Again and again, the choice of men who put good grooming first.
Sam Spade, Detective Agency.
That is the correct answer. You have just won $104 million, six deep freeze units, a stable of polo ponies with matching saddle soap, a terry cloth robe with chocolate bars pre-melted into the pockets, and a full-size, real, honest-to-goodness dreadnought, such as is used by Uncle Sam's Navy.
Oh, I'm sorry you have to call back. I'm expecting to be taking dictation from my employer very shortly.
Oh, I am sorry. Your time is up. And Edna St. Vincent Markowitz, who sent in the question, gets bumped off in front of the studio audience gathered in the Dredgewood Room here in Columbia Square. Next night, don't answer your phone, stupid.
Oh, Sam.
Let's have no coaching, please.
Oh, well, did you find the cop? Was it murder? Was it really worth some... Well, you know, priceless and like that, and was it fun?
Yes, 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 and no. And finally, are you kidding?
Well, then why was it called the Vafio Cup?
It's a very old Greek expression, which is what I'll be wearing as I sit in your lap dictating my report on the Vafio Cup Caper.
Dashiell Hammett, America's leading detective fiction writer and creator of Sam Spade, the hard-boiled private eye, and William Spear, radio's outstanding producer-director of mystery and crime drama, join their talents to make your hair stand on end with the adventures of Sam Spade. Presented by the makers of Wild Root Cream Oil for the hair. Remember the Romeo of yesteryear? Hair parted in the middle, all plastered down. Man, what a difference today. Today, all a guy has to do to impress a gal is use Wild Root Cream Oil Hair Tonic. And now, with Howard Duff starring as Spade, Wild Root brings to the air the greatest private detective of them all in the adventures of Sam Spade.
Date, August 22nd, 1948, to Jethro Chiswick, Esquire.
Oh, spelling, Sam.
E-S-Q-U...
No, Sam, I meant the name. It's Chiswro Jethwick.
I did not say Chiswro Jethwick. I said Jethro Chiswick. I mean, Chiswro... look, we'll check it later.
Oh, Sam, it might... I have an uncle in Berkeley named Smithwick.
Leave your family out of this, Eph.
But he's only by marriage, Sam. It's quite a common name.
Name three people named Chiswick.
No, Smithwick. Now, let's see, there's Uncle George and Aunt Amelia by a previous marriage. Then there's my cousin Rupert on the Christie side.
When you have finished ruminating amongst the foliage of your family tree, Miss Perrine.
Well, I only mentioned it in
all right,
that name
we'll
that you thought to...
All over again. Tear out that page.
Yes, Your Highness.
Oh, no, please. No need to curtsy. To Jethro Chiswick, no comment, please. From Samuel Spade, license number 137596. What's that?
Nothing, sir, nothing.
Subject, the Vafio Cup Caper. Dear Commodore, that's the way I like you. Neek. I had always considered myself fairly well-versed in the subject of cups. But if anybody had told me there was such a thing as a Vafio Cup, they could have knocked me over with one, which they did.
Mr. Spade?
Yeah?
I'm Chester A. Brody. I talked with your secretary on the phone. Do you follow?
Oh, yes, Mr. Brody. Sit down. Rest your package.
Thank you. I prefer to hold it for the time being. My card, sir.
Theophilus and Brody, importers and exporters, mm-hmm.
Mr. Theophilus is my partner, Dimitri Theophilus. You follow?
I follow.
It was Mr. Theophilus who brought the Vafio Cup into the firm. I furnished the cash capital.
Vafio Cup, I do not follow.
Yes, indeed. The only one of these treasures to fall into private hands. One of the fabulous Vafio Cups. Those exquisite and cunningly wrought examples of the art of the ancient Grecian goldsmith, excavated by the great Schliemann from a beehive tomb in Sparta.
Beehive.
Mycenaean age.
just west of the Lion Gate.
Oh, the Lion Gate. Pardon me, Mr. Brody. Are you trying to tell me that this cup is very valuable?
Priceless.
And that you have finally managed to find a buyer?
You follow?
And that you want me to deliver that package containing your priceless cup and return with your customer's cash?
Accurately put. I presume you're bonded.
Uncork me and see for yourself.
You are a droll fellow, to be sure.
I had a light breakfast, drolls and coffee. Now, what is this Vafio cup?
I will show it to you. You're about to see a treasure but few eyes have looked upon in our time, Mr. Spade. The Vafio cup. Handle it carefully. It's fragile. You could crush it in your hand like so much tinfoil. Yet this golden relic of a golden age has come down through the centuries miraculously unscathed. Note the delicately wrought lines of the bas-relief. The exquisite draperies on the figure of the caryatid. The anguish on the face of the fallen hunter. The sheer brute force of the wild boar charging to the kill. Holding this golden cup in your hands, you encompass 3,000 years. Do you comprehend why there's no question of insurance here?
Frankly, I don't.
My dear man, an item such as this is worth only as much as a collector will pay for it. This particular collector has offered $200,000. It might never be offered again. You follow?
I follow.
Very well. Here's your fee, $100.
I follow.
And here is the address of my client in Los Angeles, Commodore Jethro Chiswick.
Oh, now, wait a minute.
You will take the noon train. Any questions?
Yeah, why can't I go on a plane?
Because I've placed an item in this afternoon's papers to the effect that the treasure is to be transported by plane.
If I were a gunner and I read that item, I'd take the train.
That would be your first thought. Then you would think they're saying they're taking the plane to make me think they're taking the train. Therefore, you would take the plane after all. Oh, would you? If you were really clever, you might say they're taking the plane to make one think it's the train, so I'll take the plane after all, and therefore...
Never mind. By this time, he's decided on the bus. The train is perfectly safe.
You follow?
The package was light in the drawing room and the train was comfortable. Seemed like an easy way to earn $100. I knew it wouldn't last. Never does. I was prepared for the knock on the door and I got ready for the inevitable small dark man who plays the Peter Lorre part, but this one fooled me. He was a tall, thin actor with sandy hair.
Okay, Shamus, hand over the package. You won't be no trouble.
Sure, there it is on the seat. Take it.
Huh?
It's okay. You got me covered. I won't make any move.
Hey, what are you trying to pull?
It's a stick-up, isn't it?
Maybe I got the wrong compartment.
No, that's it. The cup's in there. Unwrap it and see for yourself.
No, you don't. I ain't picking up no booby traps.
Oh, you're yellow, huh?
I know that one, too. I don't cut no ice with me.
Suit yourself. Game of gin?
Hey, you're nuts. I'm getting out of here.
Hey, wait a minute, pal. I'll buy you a drink.
I don't drink.
Lunch?
In I go.
Yes, indeed, Mr. Spade, I agree. Clarence is a very comical fellow.
So are you.
I took the liberty of stepping into your forecastle whilst you had your bit of raillery in the after companionway with my mate, dear Clarence. You mind?
Not at all.
Well, sir, I'm afraid you're going to mind a great deal.
Oh!
And that's how I met you, Commodore. I was so busy sizing up the 45 in your right hand that I didn't even notice when your left whipped out of your coat pocket with one of the largest saps I have ever felt. The next time I saw light, you were gone, the Vafio cup was gone, and the train was pulling into San Jose. I got off, rode back to San Francisco with a truckload of chickens, and headed straight for my client's apartment.
You got here quick.
Yeah.
Come in.
Thanks. Well?
Well, what?
Look, we can't both play this deadpan. We'll stay no place.
It's in the back room.
What is?
The body. You're from the police, aren't you?
I'm a private victim.
How dare you?
Hey, what was that for?
For spying on me. You and all the other cheap gumshoes my husband hires.
You're Mrs. Brody?
I'm Enid Theophilus. Did my husband hire you?
My name is Sam Spade. I was hired by one Chester A. Brody, your husband's business partner.
Well, Sam, I hope he paid you in advance, because he's the body.
Chester A. Brody was just barely identifiable. Somebody had worked hard trying to persuade him to say or do something he either couldn't or wouldn't do. The only interesting clue was in the wastebasket. At first, I thought it was a flattened beer can. But it was the Vafio cup, or a facsimile thereof.
Well, how do you like it, Sam?
I don't. He was my client. I wasn't hired to protect him. I didn't like him, but he was my client.
How would you like me for a client?
I'll give you the name of a lawyer, sister.
My name is Enid.
Enid? Now, let's see what I can squeeze out of you before the cops do. Brody was your husband's business partner, and you're,
You don't have to be subtle. He was mad about me. I'm all broken up about his death.
So is he.
That wasn't funny.
That time I deserved it.
You don't like me, do you?
Can't you get it through that steel-jacketed brain of yours that you're in bad trouble, that there's a dead man in the next room beaten to death and you're not supposed to be here?
Oh, I was supposed to be here. We were going to elope as soon as you brought back the money from that Greek thing.
Yeah, what about that Greek thing?
It was an antique. It was called the Vafio Cup.
Yes, I know about that.
Well, my husband dug it up in Greece and smuggled it into the country.
Yeah?
It was all he had, but it was such an important piece that he was able to persuade Chet, the late Chester Brody, that is, to let him in as a full partner.
Then what?
Well, they quarreled. My husband made some bad investments, and Chet wanted to sell the cup to save the firm. Dimitri refused. I didn't think it was fair, so I got the keys to his safety deposit box where the cup was, and Chet arranged to sell it to the Commodore. Did you get the money from the Commodore?
All I got from the Commodore was lumps.
He stole the cup?
Roger.
You've got to get it back.
I've got it.
Where?
Here, take a look.
It's ruined. Where did you find it?
In a trash basket where it belongs.
Dimitri did it. He must have suspected something and substituted a fake. That's it. He knows where the real one is.
Somebody thought that your boyfriend knew.
The one that killed him?
That's the way it looks. Maybe that's the way it was meant to look. You know, somebody might get the idea that you palmed the genuine when you got it out of that safety deposit box.
If I did, it was legal, and don't you forget it. A wife can't steal from her husband. Legally, they're one person. You can't steal from yourself. That's the law.
I was wrong. You don't need a lawyer.
Will you help me?
I may hurt you, and it'll cost you anyway.
I know what's good for me. Money. Find that cup.
I know what's good for me, too. So I took her $100, advised her to go home, and made for my own humble lodging. They were not only humble, they were crowded. The man was small, but the gun was enormous. I said, don't bother to introduce yourself. Your name is Dimitri Theopoulos, and you want this package that I'm carrying.
And now, back to the Vafio Cup Caper. Tonight's adventure with Sam Spade.
He didn't answer me, so I said it again. Don't bother to introduce yourself. Your name is Dimitri Theopoulos, and you want this package that I'm carrying.
Of that be assured. You obtained this from my dear wife. And how did you find my darling?
Not at the city pound, surprisingly enough.
Oh, you know my dear wife. How soon you know my darling so well, more than I her husband. Is it possible?
I don't know, is it?
I don't know either. I employ a detective.
Not this one.
I have need. My poor partner, Mr. Brody. You are interesting.
If you are interesting about who killed your partner, that's one thing. But if you want somebody to dig out your family secrets, that is nothing. With me, you are, shall we say, no place.
But why? Don't I got the right to know? There'll be no trouble, no scandal, no divorcement suing. Of that be assured. Even poor Chester is dead, so he's what one calls ancient history. While he lived, I knew nothing. I was blind. After he died, I see certain things.
Yeah, well, do you see that maybe your wife had a hand in Brody's death? What then?
Well, if it so happens that you cannot separate my darling from that, do you follow?
Not quite.
Ah. I'm not an old man.
Well,
but my dear wife is but 22 and a truly lovely person.
Yeah, she's all right.
Would it not be the part of husbandly wisdom to have, shall I say, a hold over her?
If she's guilty, you won't need it.
Good. Please, I cannot hold the gun and handle my wallet at the same time. Please.
No, thanks. You keep the gun. I'll take the wallet.
Oh, you trust me. You will work for me.
Yeah, I'll work for anybody. Here, I left your cab.
Oh, assuredly, you are so very kind.
Oh, I'm not so
now
kind.
The package, yes?
No.
Then I don't hesitate to suit you.
Wait a minute.
Yes?
This is the fake. You sure you want this?
Assuredly, yes.
A man has already been killed for it. Your life's a high price to pay for a fake, though fancy, tin cup.
You still think that's the price?
Brother, I know it.
Then you know I will kill you for it.
Okay, if it means that much to you, and I guess it does, it's all yours.
Okay, thank you. Please remain where you are. If you follow me, I will surely suit you.
From my front window, I watched them come out downstairs and start across the street. Then it happened. The gun flashed as it fired, and Theophilus slumped to the pavement. The package slid away from him into the gutter. I beat it down to him. He'd taken all three pellets in the midsection from close range. His pulse fluttered once or twice and then stopped. When I went to look for the package, it wasn't there. I called homicide and waited until they took him away. When I told Lieutenant Dundee what I had in mind, he congratulated me on my brilliant scheme and told me to go ahead with it. That was his mistake. I even talked him out of assigning any of his harness men to watch my building for the next couple of hours. That was my mistake. I went upstairs, opened the bottle, and waited for your knock on my door, Commodore.
Well, sir, the man would almost think you expected us. Keep a weather eye on him, Clarence. Don't let him get lured.
Aye, sir.
Welcome aboard.
No time for scuttlebutt, Mr. Spade. We are bound for Bulilong Bali on the MacArthur Maru, sailing at dawn. I want that cup. The true, the genuine, the Baffio cup. No more deceptions, no more trickery. You will hand it over without further delay.
Sure. Be glad to.
Oh, no, not like that. You will tell Clarence where it is stowed, and Clarence will fetch it above deck.
Why, you old barnacle. Theophilus never had his mitts on a genuine Baffio cup.
Bilge water, sir. When Theophilus landed in San Francisco, he didn't have a farthing. Now he owes $500,000. If he hadn't got the genuine cup, how could he have borrowed all that money?
Because a bunch of morons like you believed he had it.
Lost my binnacles, man. You sound as though you believed what you're saying.
Look, Commodore, you're interested in high finance. Now, how did Arthur Kruger make his millions?
Why, matches. He was the match king, sir.
Matches had nothing to do with it, Commodore. He started out with 15 million bucks worth of phony government bonds that he printed himself. Follow? They weren't even good counterfeits, but he was smart enough not to try and cash them. He just kept them in a safety deposit box and borrowed money. Theophilus used his phony Vafio cup the same way.
Lost my pinnacles, man. You sound as though you believe what you're saying.
That has a familiar ring to it. I do. And I'll tell you why. He knew that that was the fake in the package when he held me up for it. He was willing to risk his own life to get it out of circulation.
Dash my timbers. Old Theophilus has left us without a shot in the locker. He steered us onto the shoals. We're on our beam ends.
Hey, turn them off, Commodore. You're pumping bilge flush. We better haul our wind.
Yes, indeed. I'm afraid it's getting rather warm in San Francisco. Bulilong beckons.
You won't make it past the potato patch.
What?
The cops are going to want some answers about a couple of stiffs you left behind in San Francisco.
I'm glad you reminded me.
Shall I plug him?
No, no. We are taking him with us.
Oh, that's what you think.
Take it easy, mate. This ain't going to hurt a bit.
A reek of chloroform filled the room and a fist pounded into my belly. Knocked my wind out, and at the same time, my nose collided with something wet and cold. I swung out but didn't connect. Before I could swing again, the room blurred and the ceiling light floated down to meet me. Then the lights went out altogether. At first, I couldn't figure it. It sounded like what a doctor hears through a stethoscope, or maybe an earthquake, or maybe ship engines, which it turned out to be. When the lights came on again, I was lying on a bunk in a stateroom. I staggered across to the wash basin and splashed water on my face.
Hello, you.
Enid, as I hardly live and breathe.
It could get worse.
Yeah, where are we?
Oh, not very far out. Not past the Farallon.
Good. I'm a stowaway, and they'll put me off of the pilot.
Oh, no, you're not. Your passage is paid.
Mine? It is, huh?
It is. Do you know who you are?
Who am I?
Chester Brody.
Then I'm dead. They'll bury me at sea.
Roger.
Who are you?
I'm your widow.
What's the score, widow?
Chester and I booked passage on this ship a week ago. It was part of the plan. Chester and the Commodore worked it all out.
Yeah, the cup was to have been stolen from me on the train.
Yes, but when the Commodore discovered it was a fake, everything fell to pieces.
Yeah, he thought Chester was double-crossing him.
They forced Chet to talk. He told them Dimitri still had the genuine Vafio cup and had hired you for the double cross. Maybe he really believed it. Anyway, they killed Dimitri.
Yeah. Well, there's nothing on them yet. But you're a material witness, sweetheart, to at least one of the killings. That's extraditable. When that dawns on them, they'll scuttle you, too.
It's already dawned on them. I'm desperate.
Yes, I notice. For you, you're practically hysterical.
We have to face facts.
Yeah, well, give me a couple to face right now. Where are the Commodore and Clarence?
Up on the bridge.
Good. All you have to do is walk straight up to the captain. He'll put them under arrest.
Well, that might be a good idea, darling. Only...
Only what?
Only the Commodore is the captain.
That, Torrid. Your salty talk had fooled me, Commodore. I never dreamed that you were really an old sea dog, and I do mean dog. But two can play at that game. From my own intimate knowledge of sea story magazines, I realized that all hands would be turned to on the cargo gear, and the crew quarters would be, therefore, empty. In more time than it takes to tell, Enid and I had fitted ourselves out in dungarees, jumpers, and watch caps, and turned to with them.
Stone up, Preventer.
Oh, me? You may recall, Commodore, you may recall me as the man who ran for a fire extinguisher when the bosun yelled, "Stow the Preventer." But experience is the best teacher, and by the time we hove to put the pilot over the side, things were in such a state of confusion that you had retreated to your cabin with a quadruple ration of grog. Seizing that moment, I threw Enid over the side, yelled, "Man overboard!" and jumped in after her. Once safely aboard the pilot schooner, we revealed our true identity and a merry laugh was enjoyed by all. It dropped us at the foot of Market, and we waved warm farewells to our erstwhile rescuers, then to the snug haven of my office in a friendly cup, if you'll pardon the expression, in the grateful warmth of a gas radiator.
Unhealthy.
Who, me?
Gas fumes. Why don't you move into a building with steam heat?
I like this building. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've been here for a long time.
You don't make much money, do you?
You don't have to rub it in. It's a living.
You happy?
Mm-hmm. Sure I am.
Well, I guess it's all right then.
You know, sweetheart, there's something missing in you.
Oh, what?
I don't know.
And then how do you know?
Forget it.
Well, I guess I'll go.
Do you mind if I don't see you to the door?
Why should I? Well...
Hey, you are human. Yeah, they're wet. Go ahead, sweetheart. Cry all you want. It's been fun. You shouldn't have kept it bottled up this long.
No, it's not what you think.
Well, what is it?
It's you... You're so nice.
I'm nice?
Yeah, but you're no place. You never will be. And neither will I.
And that, Commodore, is the cargo. It was nice seeing you again down at the hall. They tell me you and Clarence are both trying to turn state's evidence. But according to the late bulletins, Clarence was leading by a neck in the stretch. Get it? The DA was afraid the jury might not understand your salty talk. Period. End of sea chanty.
Oh, Sam.
Yes, what?
Oh, Sam.
Hmm?
Oh, I just can't.
Well, why can't you? Are you feeling okay, F?
Oh, Sam.
Hmm?
You betrayed your trust. You...
Effie, speak to me. What is it? What is it? I betrayed my trust. What?
Those criminals were on that boat.
Yes?
And you... You jumped overboard.
You feel that I was recalcitrant, is that it? That my actions were not true blue, clear cut, is that it?
Oh, I'll just go type this up, and I'm sure you can explain. I hope you can. I hope.
Sour racket.
Question. What's the easiest and best way there is to give your hair that well-groomed look? Answer, Wild Root Cream Oil.
Here it is, Sam. I hope the spelling is all right. I was so upset.
You hate me, then?
Oh, no. No. I suppose it's foolish going along thinking that your ideal doesn't have feet of clay. Oh, Sam, I just can't imagine.
Don't you think I can explain that?
Oh, yes, I'm sure you can explain. But you did. You deserted your post and jumped overboard like a sinking rat.
That's right.
Oh, Sam, that's so unlike you. It was just by chance they were apprehended.
By chance, you say? Who do you think it was that got himself shot out of a torpedo tube in that submarine?
You, Sam?
No, you think I'm crazy? I did something few radio detectives ever do, sweetheart. I called the Harbor Patrol single-handed using only one nickel and had them picked up.
Oh, Sam, I wish I'd been there.
Well, it was just a small phone booth. Besides, if you'd been there, it would have been out of order or something.
Oh, Sam, you came through after all.
Aren't you ashamed that you ever doubted me?
Yes, I am. I'm a fool.
There. I forgive you.
Good night, Sam.
Good night, sweetheart.
The Adventures of Sam Spade, Dashiell Hammett's famous private detective, are produced and directed by William Spear. Sam Spade is played by Howard Duff. Loreen Tuttle is Effie. The Adventures of Sam Spade are written for radio by Bob Tallman and Gil Dowd. Musical direction is by Lud Gluskin, with score composed by Rene Garrigan. Join us again next Sunday when author Dashiell Hammett and producer William Spear join forces for another adventure with Sam Spade. Brought to you by Wild Root Cream Oil.
The Adventures of Sam Spade, on Tuned to Yesterday, a CBS episode from August 22nd, 1948. Looking at the ratings of the period, the show had been on the air for 3 years, heard Sunday nights at 8 o'clock, and was drawing close to 11 million listeners a week. About 5 million listeners behind the other thriller dramas of the period, like Suspense and This Is Your FBI, both drawing around 16 million to their sets each week. This is an hour of mystery on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. Now time for The New Adventures of Michael Shane with The Case of the Generous Killer, a syndicated episode from in and about the year 1948.
Have a seat.
No, thanks. I always like to stand.
Oh?
When you're only 5 feet tall, you prefer to stand.
Suit yourself. What can I do for you?
Here.
That's $100 bill.
Yes, for you.
Me? What for?
I don't know much more about it than you, Mr. Shane.
Look, you must, because I don't know anything about it. How come you're giving me $100 bill?
Oh, I'm not giving it to you. It's not mine.
Oh, wait a minute. Let's not play guessing games.
Well, all I know is that a man gave me this to give you and gave me one just like it for doing it.
A man who?
A passenger on the Star of Bermuda.
Oh, the Star of Bermuda. What? Look, friend, I think you better start at the beginning. You're leaving me way behind.
Well, I know it doesn't make much sense, but all I can tell you is what happened. I'm ship's cook on the Star of Bermuda, the Transatlantic.
Yeah.
We docked here at New Orleans yesterday, and we're shoving off at dark.
Yeah.
Just about an hour ago, a little before dark it was, a passenger came aboard.
Did he give you his name?
No.
Oh, fine.
He just paid me to bring you this $100 bill.
But didn't he say why? Didn't he tell you what he wanted me to do?
I'm coming to that.
Well, let's have it. What is it?
Mr. Shane, he's paying you the $100 to come and arrest him.
Well, the day had made perfect sense, up to now. I'd had my ham and eggs bright and early, spent most of the morning in the courthouse checking on some records for a client, most of the afternoon explaining them to him. So there I was, a little after dark, sitting in my office, peacefully reading the newspaper. When a pint-sized ship's cook from a tramp steamer eases into my office, gives me $100 bill, and tells me a passenger on his boat sent it to me so I'd come down and arrest him. After which the little guy leaves, and I spend about half an hour trying to figure out the deal. Well, I finally gave up, because nothing about it made sense. Except, of course, one thing, the $100 bill. As far as I was concerned, that made very good sense. Seemed like a pretty good reason for me to mosey down to the Star of Bermuda. So I slipped the $100 bill into the solitary confinement of my wallet and went down to the waterfront. The Star of Bermuda was just about the tackiest looking tramp I've seen in a long while. I went up the gangway. The only sign of life was a deckhand lounging against the rail. Hello?
Yeah?
You, got a passenger aboard?
Yeah.
Where's his captain?
Aft.
How far aft?
Stern.
Oh, look, Chatterbox, do you mind telling me just where? I'm no sea scout.
Only cabin. Can't miss it. Probably a light on.
Oh, wait a minute. Don't overdo. You better stop for a breath. Thanks.
Welcome.
I started walking toward the stern, my footsteps echoing on the deck. And then, sure enough, I saw a stab of light coming from under a cabin door. No answer. Still no answer. Unlocked. Then I stopped. It looked like my client had decided he couldn't wait to be arrested. He was hanging at the end of a rope, swinging gently back and forth with the motion of the ship, and he was buried dead. I took a long look at the guy, and then I got a very smart idea, which was to get out of there and get out fast. But it was no good. When I got to the door, I ran right into something black and bullish, only this bull didn't have horns.
Where is he, Shane?
You'll probably find this hard to believe, Inspector, but I don't know.
Thanks. Cut him down and search him.
Yeah, okay.
Let's try it again, Shane. Who is he?
I'm stuck with the same answer, LaFever. I'd never laid eyes on him until about 10 seconds before you got here.
Yeah.
All I know is this guy sent me $100 bill by way of the ship's cook to come down here and arrest him. Okay, so I came down. Here he was hanging.
Didn't send word why he wanted to be arrested?
Nope.
Wonder if we knew the net was closing in, but he'd have a better shake his way.
Yeah, don't follow. You know who this guy is or was?
Thanks.
No identification, Inspector.
There's your answer, Shane.
Yeah, but maybe you've got a hunch.
This could be our boy. We don't know. No way to tell now.
Well, he must have given a name when he reserved his cabin.
Ziegler. Doesn't mean a thing. Might as well be who I am.
You wouldn't care to tell me who you think he might be?
That's right.
Huh?
I wouldn't.
Oh. Well, boys, this has been nice. I think maybe, though, I better be getting back to town. That is, of course, if you don't mind.
Oh, we don't mind. We got nothing on you, Shane. Not now. Well, it might be a good idea for you to get back to town. Only just don't leave town.
Well, of course, all I could do at that point was send Inspector LaFever an RSVP to his cordial invitation to remain in New Orleans. My RSVP read, "Yes, Inspector." About then, the coroner arrived, and I followed the inspector and Sergeant Dykes down the gangway and along the pier to the street at the end where their car was. There was a little lunch counter nearby with a few assorted floaters lounging around. Among them, a skinny, nervous, slippery character appropriately nicknamed the Weasel. A guy who made his living selling information and anything else he could steal. As I walked by the stand, Weasel looked at me. Rolled his cigarette from one side of his mouth to the other, let one of his eyelids droop a little. I got the message. I watched the two plainclothesmen drive away, and sure enough, pretty soon, the Weasel eased over to me.
Hello, Mikey.
What's on your mind?
I want to talk to you.
What about?
It's big, Mikey.
Yeah, and crooked.
Nah, Mikey, you got it wrong. It's big and level.
That'd be the day.
Oh, I'm giving it to you straight. It's hot, Mikey.
Okay, come on. We'll go have a cup of coffee.
Nah. Too many people. Come on. I know where we can talk.
I followed Weasel partway out on the pier again to a deserted warehouse. He slid the door open and motioned me to follow. It was dark as pitch inside, but that seemed to be the way Weasel wanted it.
Now we can talk, Mikey.
Okay, start.
It's about the guy hanging from the rope.
What about him?
That's what I'm telling you. I go aboard that boat to see an old pal, so I'm looking for him back aft. This cabin door is open a little, so I look inside, and there's a guy swinging by his neck.
Well, don't leave me there.
Oh, gee, it really rocks you to see something like that, but then in a minute I kind of got a hold of myself, and I go on in. And I sort of sized the guy.
Why?
Why? Because, I figured I want to find out who he is.
Yeah, you mean you figure you'll lift his wallet?
Oh, no, Mike.
You know, that's about the one thing I figured you'd draw the line at, robbing a dead man.
I tell you,
I was wrong, I guess. Now, quit trying to sell that yarn about wanting to find out who he is.
Well, okay, Mike. Fella's got to make a buck somewhere. But I did find out who the guy is, Mikey.
All right, let's have it, then.
There were some papers in his wallet, letters, stuff like that, and they show that this guy is Victor Groves.
Victor Groves. The name hit me like a bulldozer. All of a sudden, a lot of things started making sense.
His name was in the headlines because Victor Groves was a hired killer, but he was only a name. Nobody had ever seen him except his victims, and they naturally were never in a position to identify him. But why Victor Groves had sent the money to me to arrest him, why he'd decided to hang himself before I got there, still didn't add up. And neither did Weasel's angle in lifting the papers.
Don't you get the pitch, Mikey? You and me. We're the only ones who know the stuff is Victor Groves.
So?
So? So there ought to be a payoff. The cops probably fork over something to find it out. So then they could call off the hunt.
Got it all figured out, haven't you, Weasel?
Sure, sure. I don't dare go near the cops, but you can. So you handle the arrangements and we split the take. Right down the middle, huh?
I'll have to think it over.
Think it over nothing. We gotta work fast.
All right, give me the papers,
huh? Oh, no. Weasel keeps the papers.
Come on, let's have them.
No, Mikey.
Give them to me or it's no deal.
But, Mikey, I...
Give them, I say.
Okay. Only, how do I know I can trust you?
You don't.
Always kidding. Huh, Mikey?
Yeah, always kidding. Look, I'll get in touch with you tomorrow morning near the lunch stand. I'll give you my answer then. In the meantime, I'll keep the papers in a safe place.
Step back out on the pier. Weasel stood watching me as I started down the pier. I wondered if he had a hunch about what was going on in my mind. If he did, there was going to be trouble. Because what was going on in my mind was I was going to march right down to police headquarters and turn those papers in. Yeah, Michael was going to be very law-abiding this time. And then something happened that froze me in my tracks. There's a scream from 50 yards behind me, from Weasel. I whirled around. The scream ended in a horrible gurgle. I pounded back toward him, but he had already crumpled up over the pier. Even in the dim light, I could see his throat had been cut very recently. I started around the warehouse after the killer. All of a sudden, I was spread eagled in the air, and my head splattered on the pier, and a million stars exploded in front of my eyes. And then all the lights went out.
We'll return to Mike Shane and the case of the General Killer.
It all started when a $100 bill was dropped on my desk by a 5-foot-high ship's cook who told me a passenger on a tramp steamer wanted me to come down and arrest him. So I went and found the passenger swinging from the end of a rope. Inspector Lefevre arrived about then and found no identification on him.
Then pretty soon a slippery character named Weasel led me into a warehouse and told me he'd lifted the papers from the dead man. The papers had proved the guy was Victor Groves, a hired killer that nobody'd ever seen. I got the papers away from Weasel and started down the pier. Weasel got his throat cut. I ran around the warehouse after the killer when a hand grabbed my ankle and I knocked myself out on the pier. And then, after a while, the haze started thinning out a little. And there I was, riding along in the back seat of a squad car with one of Lefevre's boys, Sergeant Dykes.
Shane, what are you trying to do? Shake down the police force?
Shake down it? Now, wait a minute, Dykes. Let's have it slow and clear, and from the beginning.
Okay. Only maybe I won't be telling you anything you don't already know. A couple of weeks ago, Victor Groves killed one of the boys on the force.
Yeah, I read the papers.
Then we find you standing in the stateroom watching a man swinging at the end of a rope.
Look, Sergeant, I told you the ship's cook brought me a $100 bill from this passenger to come down and arrest him.
Uh-uh. When we left you, we drove around the block and walked back to the ship. The cook tells us he hasn't been ashore all day.
Well, he's lying.
Says he hardly ever goes ashore. Hates land. Weighs a shade over 300 and has trouble getting around.
300? No.
Oh, yeah. So we start down the gangway going to look for you. But you save us the trouble. There's a scream farther out on the pier and then someone running. We got out and find a stoolie named Weasel lying dead and you unconscious. Then we find Victor Groves' identification papers on you.
I got them from the Weasel. He lifted them from the dead man.
Oh, yeah.
Look, Dykes, you got it all wrong. Groves committed suicide.
It don't boil, Shane. The knots in the rope and some of the bruises on Groves' neck told us it was no suicide. It was murder. He was strangled.
Well, about that time, I was willing to sell my Social Security number very cheap.
two murders, with me sitting in the chief suspect's chair on both of them. I guess it was a little after 1 a.m. when my cell door opened and clanged shut again. I looked up. Inspector Lefebvre was standing there.
Shane.
Hello, Inspector.
Let's talk.
Why, it's been a losing game for me so far.
Seems to be quite a case against you.
Yeah, according to just about everybody but me. Look, Inspector, I didn't kill Gross. I didn't lift his papers, and I didn't kill the weasel.
That might be kind of hard to prove. How about the weasel, that is?
Well, maybe somebody will tell me how I managed to slit his throat, get rid of a knife, and then knock myself out.
Mm-hmm. You could have managed it.
Okay.
But I don't think you did.
But what?
No, I don't think you killed the weasel, and I'm pretty sure you didn't kill Victor Gross.
Well, what do you think I've been trying to tell your boys all night?
No. You know, Shane, the passenger who was choked to death, we identified him. He is not Victor Gross.
He's not Gross?
Mm-hmm.
Well, then...
Then it adds up why Weasel was killed.
Because the real Victor Gross found out Weasel had lifted the papers from the dead man and thought Weasel still had them.
Could have been that way.
It has to be that way, Inspector. Look, Victor Gross knows you're out to get him, so he gets a drifter from the waterfront into that stateroom on the tramp steamer. He kills the guy, plants his own papers on him, strings him up to make it look like suicide, and then he...
Hey, wait a minute. That little guy who brought me the 100
said he was the ship's cook. He must have been the real Victor Gross.
That's the way it's beginning to look, Shane. He wants you to come down, discover the body. Then everybody thinks Gross committed suicide, the case is closed, and the pressure's off the real Gross.
That little guy, who would have ever figured that he... I can't even remember much what he looked like.
Try to remember, will you?
Yeah, but I wasn't paying much attention. I remember he was very small.
What about the face?
Oh, thin face. Straight nose, dark eyes. That's about it.
Not enough.
The best I can do.
All right. We're releasing you, Shane.
Well, I wouldn't say it's about time, Inspector, but it is about time. Hey... Wait a minute.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone besides the police force know that the dead passenger has been identified as someone other than Gross?
No.
That's what I thought. And something else. Does anyone know I've been arrested and don't have Gross's papers on me anymore?
Nobody outside knows that.
Thanks a lot. I'll stay here.
Mm-mm. We're letting you go.
I like it here all of a sudden.
You can't stay here,
Shane. Look, I know what you've been leading up to. As far as Gross is concerned, I've still got the papers.
Mm-hmm.
You think I'm going to walk the streets of New Orleans waiting for him to make a pass at me?
We do.
Now, get yourself another boy. This one just quit.
One of our boys will tell you. He'll grab Gross if Gross comes after you.
Look, Inspector, you don't know what you're asking me to do.
You're wrong there, Shane. I know just what I'm asking you to do. Make a target out of yourself. You know why?
I don't care why. I'm not going to...
Because a killer's still running around loose. A killer nobody can identify. And he'll strike again soon because he guns not only for hire but for pleasure. He's vicious. He's got to be stopped, and this is one way that might work. Now, how about it?
Look, Inspector, you and your boys have been giving me a rough time. You throw me in a clink, you... Okay, I'll do it.
This ought to do, Shane.
Sure, Dykes. One place is as good as another.
You got it straight now.
Too straight. I'm to go back to my office building and start out alone, on foot.
Right. Keep away from crowds and keep away from the brightly lit streets.
Oh, fine. What am I supposed to do, roost in a dark alley somewhere?
Just keep away from the bright lights. And get this. When you leave your office building, walk south a block. Then go any direction you want, because that's the point our boy will start tailing you from. One block south of your office.
Yeah.
Uh-oh, just one more thing.
What is it?
Good luck.
I found an all-night cab stand and grabbed a taxi back to my office building. Just as I was going to start walking, a woman came out of the building and crossed the street. A short woman. Then as I stood there watching, it dawned on me. As I turned north in sort of a daze, I was realizing my job was just twice as tough as I'd thought. Because it had just hit me that Victor Gross was plenty small enough to pass for a woman. By the time I digested that pleasant thought, I realized I was about a block and a half from my office. I slowed down, looked around. The streets were pretty deserted. I spotted the car as soon as it turned the corner and came toward me very slowly. I stopped. The car kept coming. I was hoping Inspector Lefebvre's boy was awfully close and ready. Then the
car was slowing still more. I got opposite me, it stopped. The window toward me started rolling down, but I couldn't see inside, so I waited, and then...
Hey, Bud, how do I get to St. Louis Street from here?
I told him. Stood there watching him drive away. Took out my handkerchief and mopped my face a little. Then I started walking again. A little lady with a tray of flowers had been standing near the entrance of a bar, started crossing a narrow street toward me. I stopped. She had a shawl over her head, and she was short. I stood there and watched as she came up to me.
A flower, monsieur? A flower for your lapel, perhaps?
Yeah, sure. You're working late tonight.
Oh, I always work late. Here, a nice carnation.
Okay, thanks, here. Yeah.
Oh, merci, monsieur. Oh, but monsieur, is it too much? Monsieur!
But I was already around the corner. I didn't somehow care about staying in one place too long. The thing was getting to me a little. It seemed like all the inhabitants of New Orleans that I'd seen in the last half hour had shrunk about 6 inches suddenly. Like the guy coming down the sidewalk toward me right now. I couldn't tell where he'd come from. He was just suddenly there. I was right near the mouth of an alley, and for a minute I was tempted to dive into it, but I just stood there waiting. He was taking his time, like the other people I'd waited for. I couldn't see his face. He was pretty close now. For the third time, I was hoping the fever's boy had the situation well in hand. Then the guy was right in front of me.
Hey, pal, happen to have a light on you?
I still couldn't see his face. I couldn't tell from his voice, so I took a match out of my pocket. I held it out and scratched it with my thumbnail. A little flame squirted up and outlined his face. It was a round face. It didn't belong to Victor Gross. The guy puffed a couple of times on his cigarette, thanked me, and walked off. I leaned against the building for a minute. I was having that letdown feeling of relief again. But when I heard the dog whimpering with pain in the alley behind me, I didn't even hesitate. I walked into the alley. As soon as I did, I realized there was no dog. There never had been. Just a little too late, though. A hand shot around my throat. I could feel the point of a knife in my ribs. There was a soft voice in my ear.
Well, Mr. Shane, we meet again, don't we?
My throat told me I wasn't supposed to say anything. Victor Gross had gotten to me at last. Inspector Lefebvre's boy was nowhere in sight.
Now, Mr. Shane, the identification papers, please.
I don't have money, Victor.
Please. I have very little time.
I tell you, I don't have money.
You're not in your office. I've searched it thoroughly. You do not have them on you. So I have wasted my time following you. But perhaps it will not be entirely wasted time, Mr. Shane.
What do you mean?
Simply that under the circumstances, I fortunately have no other alternative but to dispose of you.
Oh, look,
quiet!
I had heard the scuffling steps a second or two before and was hoping Gross hadn't heard them, but he had. He just stood there in the alley, and I knew if I made a single sound, I'd get that knife, all 6 inches of it. The steps came nearer to the mouth of the alley, and they turned into the alley. Now a little figure loomed up in front of us. The scream pulled Gross's eyes off me just long enough. I swung my elbow back hard. I was lucky. The knife went flying across the alley. Then I got hold of one of those fingers that were wrapped around my throat. I put everything I had into it. Just enough. The fingers snapped and the hand fell away, and I swung my fist hard. Victor Gross bounced off the wall and flopped to the ground and lay still. Just then a flashlight stabbed into the alley. A big guy followed it in. It was Lefebvre's boy. So everything was okay. And then... Then I remembered the little old woman. She was cowering over one side of the alley, trembling. I went over to her. It was the flower lady. And all the people I was expecting, you weren't the one.
But I was following you. I saw you enter the alley from down the block.
Yeah, but why?
You would not stop. I called to you. You gave me too much money, monsieur.
What are you talking about? I gave you a buck and told you to keep
but
the change.
But that is just it, monsieur. It was not $1. It was $100 bill.
What?
I knew you had made a mistake. I had to return it to you.
Well, you know that it's quite a nice touch. Gross his own $100 bill is the thing that traps him.
What, monsieur?
Nothing. But, do me a favor. Keep the dough, will you? I kind of think you earned it. Well, that was just about that. Except I had a bone to pick with Inspector Lafitte. Later in his office, I brought it up. You know, that plainclothesman of yours who was supposed to be tailing the inspector, he wasn't exactly Johnny on the spot. I was beginning to think he'd never show up.
He almost didn't, but it wasn't his fault. He was lucky to find you at all.
What do you mean?
Remember what your instructions were about leaving your office tonight?
Yeah, I was to walk south a block and the boy would start tailing me from there.
Right. Maybe had a lot on your mind when left your office.
Let's see. I just realized Groves might be disguised as a woman. I guess it.
Oh, no. Oh, yeah.
I
You walked north instead of south.
You mean all the time your boy wasn't even close?
That's right. You were all alone.
Inspector.
Hmm?
You know where I could get a good compass? Cheap?
This is your director, Bill Russo, again. Our story is based on characters created by Brett Halliday. The music is composed and conducted by John Duffy, and Michael Shane is portrayed by Jeff Chandler.
The New Adventures of Michael Shane, on Tuned to Yesterday, a syndicated episode from 1948. Wrapping up this hour of mystery on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's past. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levonier. Thanks for tuning in.